From Pacifica Radio, KPFT 90.1 Houston, this is Open Journal in Exile. Open Journal is the Houston community magazine of the airwaves. Join us as Duane Bradley and Stephanie Coleman explore the wonder that is the Petro Metro and the people who make it happen. And now from our temporary, socially distanced, alternative studios in exile, somewhere in the greater Houston area, this is Open Journal in Exile. Let the conversation begin.
Yes, yes, yes. Indeed, welcome aboard. You are tuned in to Open Journal in Exile. I'm Duane Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. The Houston-based Center for the Healing of Racism is dedicated to the healing of racism through education and empowerment. The organization's roots go back to 1989, when an ethnically diverse group of individuals met in Houston to discuss the impacts of racism. Founder and co-director Cherry Steinwinder of the Center for the Healing of Racism is with us today. Joel Goza is also with us this evening. He is a writer, minister, and advocate. His first book, America's Unholy Ghost, The Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics, is an examination of the religious and secular thinkers who inspired our founding fathers and leaders' addiction to racism and classist ideas. Cherry and Joel, thanks for joining us again on Open Journal to continue this very important conversation.
Stephanie, it is really my pleasure. And I want to thank Duane for inviting us again. And, you know, I'm really working now with my co-partner. Yeah, that's who I'm working with.
So great to be with y'all. It's good to be with friends in moments like these, for sure.
Well, we had the beginning of a pretty wide-ranging conversation a few weeks ago on this, and it's such an important topic in these times, and it's some of the unresolved issues that go back to the very founding of the United States of America 244 years ago this past week, and it seems more and more that we see polarization and we see divides across this country. One of the things I had asked about in our last visit was whether or not the model of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission might be something that we could look at here in the United States as something we could build on and maybe have some reconciliation here and move forward into, you know, towards our 250th anniversary as a nation. And into our, you know, many decades looking forward. What do y'all think about those possibilities? And what kind of things have come your way as we've experienced over this 4th of July break since we last visited? We've seen our president using the trope of Mount Rushmore, talking about how these monuments cannot be taken down and that these far-left liberals or socialists and communists are trying to rewrite American history and indoctrinate the youth of today to change our country from what it was. And pretty soon we're going to be yanking down not just those Civil War traitor statues that are rightfully being challenged all across the country, but you know, and not only the state flag of Mississippi finally being taken down as the final one of those emblems that are holding up this torch of the past. I'm not sure where I'm going with that question, y'all, but I feel like I'm just kind of winding up this conversation.
And yeah.
I want to hear where you're at with where we've been since we last sat together.
Well, I remember very well the conversation about the Truth and Reconciliation that was held in South Africa. And I remember saying very well that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission was called together. And one of the main reasons to give the people, the Black people of South Africa that lived under that apartheid system, a chance to be able to really know what happened to their loved ones. When your child is taken away and murdered, burned to death, because some of these people were burned to crisp, and you don't even know where they are. And you have this sheet, because I remember seeing the sheet in a documentary with all of these names, and you have no idea where they are. This gave an opportunity for the people that was involved in committing all these atrocities to tell that story. And because of telling the story, it was like they were absolved. Mm-hmm. So when you look at having a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, I'm all for it. But the bottom line is, what is the justification for having one? Is it the same as in South Africa so that we could absolve everybody of their sins or whatever? But the other thing, too, is to look at even what the word reconciliation means. Because it may not mean the same thing to everybody. So I'm going to stay right there because I don't want to take everything away from Joel.
Yeah, well, I appreciate a little room. I appreciate that. And I think, you know, one of the things that also has to be highlighted within those conversations is the context that the Truth and Reconciliation Commission happened. Because the context of it was radical systemic changes. And there is always a desire, I think, for most of us, for reconciliation. And yet, the temptation is always before us is to skip the step of reparations, to skip the step of justice. Mm-hmm. And but what I liked about some of the things that you see transpire in South Africa was that it was holistic. It was systemic. It was political. It was spiritual. There was some systemic changes that really took place. And I believe that holistic model can be a very helpful pathway. But one of the threats always within the way we think about these things in America is solutions that are sentimental rather than substantive. Mm-hmm. And I am not at all painting the Truth and Reconciliation Commission as sentimental. It wasn't. But if we translate it to America, we got to make sure that it still has the same type of substance that it did when it was originally conceived by the revolutionaries in South Africa.
So do you have any suggestions on how something like that could be constructed effectively, Joel? Then you, Cherry, if you'd like.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, since the late 1980s, John Conyers has been coming to the floor with a reparations proposal that it needs to be studied, that we need to take very direct steps in addressing the long history of racist public policies in this nation to bring about equality. Following Conyers, Houston, Sheila Jackson Lee picked up that mantle. And within the context of reparations, I believe is the context for a Truth and Justice, the type of work that is there. So this work has been before us as a people for well over 20 years, 30 years. And one of the things I think that we always have to keep in mind is that we have always had answers to the racial crisis within America. It's just that we have always ignored the people who had those answers. We ignored the MLKs. We ignored the John Conyers. Before that, we ignored Douglass and Wells and the radical visions that they had. But I mean, I would see that the radical steps of taking up Representative Jackson Lee's proposal to begin an earnest study of the work of reparations and what is needed. And a lot of work has been done, but it needs to be done in real time and with what we're facing now as a nation.
Do you think there are some challenges? And I'll ask Cherry that same question as Joel was discussing. Like, is it possible within our lifetime not just to consider how we would apply this, but how do we get out of the theory of application? Or is it always a conversation?
Well, what I would say is that right now, I think the major job that we have to focus on, period, we have to keep this movement alive. Mm-hmm. I don't want to wake up next month and see nothing about this movement. I don't want to wake up and see nothing in the papers. And I don't want the language to disappear, period, because we have opened up the floodgates. And I think it's up to every individual to keep this conversation alive. But then I want to go back to the reparations, and I'm not quite sure if I said this in our first interview together. Remind me if I did. I've been doing so many interviews.
But, we've all been Zooming a lot.
And I'm forgetting which interview I was on. But I think it's very important because it was in the mid-90s when on the floor of Congress, I think his first name is Tony, Congressperson, brought up the apology for slavery. And what happened in this country is that even KPFT, if you could remember, Duane, people were calling in and they were talking about they never owned any slaves and why should they apologize? And all. You see, that is, to me, it really insulted my intelligence because I know the people alive today, the white men alive today, have owned no slaves. I know that. So for you to even say that to me, that an apology isn't necessary because you didn't do anything. But I feel very strongly, and I said this occasionally, that one of the very first lessons we learn as little children is to say, I'm sorry. And it's not so much for what we did, but even when we see another child hurt, I'm so sorry. You got a bobo? Did that hurt? And so what is it about us that we leave those basic fundamental lessons and we grow up to be adults and just want to dismiss everything? And the bottom line is to be able to pay reparations. I feel very strongly that people of African descent should be paid reparations. The thing of it is, I'm not going to say what it looked like, but something should happen. And the reason that I say that, I want to be labeled as a full human being in this country. And if the people of Japanese descent was paid some type of reparations, if Native Americans paid some type, I think I want to be aligned that I too am fully human and is in deserving of.
You know, it's really, as you talk about being human and the notion of still being on paper registered as 3/5 of a human in this nation, is really at the core of many of the challenges we have if you're talking about how you're documented and how do you both feel that that plays a role in reparations, in redefining of a people and redefining of a right of those people to be claimed as more than just a way to, you know, sort of get voting leveraged in your on your favor.
Okay. And you did say that either one of us could answer it.
Joe, yeah.
I had that long, you know, not give you a chance.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about the 3/5 compromise. One of the things throughout U.S. history that has always happened is that political compromises have generally taken place on the grounds of white supremacy. And so there has been kind of this natural bipartisanship throughout America's history between its parties and agreeing on a lot of the most racial devastating legislation imaginable. When you think of recent history, the war on welfare became bipartisan, imprisoning people became bipartisan. When you look at how the 3/5 evolves throughout American history, one of the things that MLK said is he said, we used to be 60% of a person in this nation. Now we're only 50%. Of everything that is good, we've got half as much. Of everything that is bad, we've got double. When you look at where we're at today, wealth-wise, African-American families are generally 1/10 of a person in American society today. And the reason that that is the case is because we've continually compromised our moral bearings on these issues. And even with some of the type of rationality that people use to reject reparations today, well, slaveholders in the days of slavery, they were blaming their parents for them being slave owners. Mm-hmm. I mean, that I can quote you a lot. I mean, Jefferson in writing the Declaration of Independence try to blame Britain for America's addiction to slavery. Mm-hmm. So at no point have we taken the ownership, you know, and I mean, you know, I'm someone, our family owns slaves, you know, that's part of my history. And I can choose to deny that history, or I can choose to own it. And that is part of the challenges that faced us, where we can say, you know, I am sorry for this history, and my family commits to work for racial justice. Mm-hmm. And not in sentimental ways, but in economic ways, in political ways, in very meaningful ways. So three-fifths is a perfect epitome of the type of compromises we've made. And when three-fifths fell from the Constitution, and African Americans gained the right to vote and do other things, the type of ideas that were behind three-fifths, mm-hmm. those didn't change. Mm-hmm. And you still had all these myths of the inferiority within the African American community and a willingness only to share the smallest piece of the American pie with African Americans.
And then to add to that conversation, when we conduct dialogue racism, which we've been conducting since 1990, we never, ever let people forget that every institution in this country started from the Federalist Papers and that whole three-fifths of a human. And so if you play that out, a lot of times I will say to people, what I am objecting to is being enslaved in this country. But then there's a bigger issue. It was not being a full human being in this country. And until we can let people know this on a larger scale. So it's about being enslaved. And it's not about being enslaved. It's about not being a full human being in this country. And everything that I try to stress is that you make me human, like every other group of people that have come to this country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You're tuned to a special edition of Open Journal in Exile. We're discussing, of course, the overarching topic of racism in the United States and on this planet. In these times, we're blessed to be sharing our space with Sherry Steinwender from the Center for the Healing of Racism and Joel Goza, local author and activist, author of the compelling book, America's Unholy Ghosts, Racist Roots of Our Faith and Politics. We appreciate both of them sharing their time and expertise with us on Open Journal, and we thank you, dear friend, for joining us and for supporting this independent radio station. I'm Dwayne Bradley.
And I'm Stephanie Coleman. You know, as we get to Houston, let's say even more specifically, I don't know for those of you listeners and Sherry or Joel, who's seen the film The Strange Demise of Jim Crow, which really has a very itemized conversation of how Houston was integrated and how it sort of handpicked those individuals that it felt it could give privilege to without giving equity to the whole. How can we, as Houston, let's say on a very local level, how can we address the inequities of education and health and politics and policy so that at least our own citizens, our own future, whether there's, you know, federal changes or any other sort of regional change, what do you think Houston can do to right the wrong of its own history and do better moving forward?
Stephanie, it's very interesting you cited that book, and to be able to be in the position before the book was published, before the documentary was filmed or completed, the author of that book came to the center along with Mr. Stearns, and they wanted me to take a look at that before it, you know, was totally published. But I want to say what Mr. Stern said when he was arrested for driving in a car with a white woman, and he went into the courthouse, and on the walls of the courthouse here in Houston, Texas, it was liberty and justice for all. And he walked in the courtroom and he pointed. He said, "That's why I'm here, because I want some liberty and I want some justice."
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That is, and so to be able to understand Houston's history, because our young children, when they are studying about the civil rights struggles in the South, they did not see Houston anywhere there.
Right.
And you see, that was a reason for it, because a bunch of people, the movers and shakers of the city, got together behind closed doors and they came up with an agreement that they would integrate Houston, Texas, one person at a time. And so people of African descent had a little more clout, a little more education. They allowed them to go to Guido's and, you know, all these other places. So when you look at that history, our children don't know that history. And that is something that needs to be taught so that they would know that Houston was in this mix, but it wasn't part of the burning and, you know, all this other stuff. But we also rode on the bus to Freedom Riders and everything else. But let's look at now, because I think that is the thing. And I think so much of it have to start with education. You know, it wasn't too long ago that the books, educational books that would teach children in Houston, Texas, as well as a large part of the nation, how they portrayed people of Latin descent in those books. You know, in Arizona, when they banned any type of cultural history of people of Latin descent, I don't see how you can teach history in Arizona without talking about Latin people, which Arizona was one time Mexico. So I really feel we have done a poor job of telling the whole truth, you know, laying the whole truth out there for children to be able to come up with critical thinking. So how are we going to do this? We're going to have to do some major changes in the way we educate children. And then we cannot allow institutions to do it. We have to also, as parents or anybody that's in charge of taking care of nurturing young children, we have to start learning this history ourselves, because a lot of us don't even know it.
I think, you know, I think the education piece is huge. You know, I think one of the things that we have to recognize is that there are cities throughout America who have taken racial justice much more seriously than what Houston has. And so it's not like that there's not examples of work that can be done. Chicago has done some stuff. Charlotte has done some stuff. Atlanta has done some stuff. But when we look at the way that Houston operates, you know, it is an addicted to a free market mentality that has compounded the racial injustices of our city. And so when we look at the work that's before us, we need a living wage in our city. You know, we need that now. A lot of the work of reparations, the way that I envision it, is that it has to begin righting the relationship between the most wealthy and the most marginalized. And as a city, that is work that we can intentionally undertake if we want to. I find it really interesting that, you know, we pretend that we don't have enough money to educate our children, but we have billionaires throughout our city. Yeah. Why we lead the nation in creating millionaires. For Houston to take racial justice seriously would have to involve questioning every principle that we have as a city, and really re-examining those foundations and finding the leverage points to becoming the type of city that we could be proud of, rather than a city that places a man on the moon and then sends children to bed hungry. Children whose parents work full time. You know, the work that to do this is very practical, and it's everything from big ideas to very small ideas. One of the things I have found interesting in working about reparations is the people that I have found who believed in America's ability to really change, who believed in that most deeply, always came from the African-American activist tradition. That, you know, Frederick Douglass would talk about our nation being reborn. MLK would talk about it. Ida B. Wells thought that our nation and our cities could be transformed. And I think that we have to take those convictions very seriously, that not only is it possible, but it can happen, and it can happen in our lifetime.
Cherry Steinwender, what's your feedback on that?
I think you cannot do it and leave out the whole judicial, you know, system that locked people up for minor in fractions where they have to give up so many years of their life. I think that it is very important that we look at this. I think it's very important that we really take serious about a jury of our peers, which doesn't always happen. And so it is very important also is that the laws and the changes that will be made because of what has happened in this country with the, and I have to say its name because it haven't come up yet. And we have to always remember George Floyd and because of what happened to him is that I go back to what we were talking about, the three-fifth humans, and I'm wondering how much of that plays into how we are policed in this city, in this country. So I think that's a large part of it, of not three-fifth, not being seen as fully human. Therefore, I can do this to you.
Mm-hmm. You're tuned to Open Journal on Pacifica Radio, 90.1 FM in Houston. We're visiting today with Joel Goza and Cherry Steinwender. And as we were just talking about the city of Houston, it reminded me that years ago, I went downtown to City Hall and I looked at this beautiful Art Deco structure that's, you know, where the mayor and city council hang out. And we go sometimes to pop off and just, you know, vent our spleen and let them know how we really feel about things. And there's this beautiful Art Deco lobby. And around it, there are some amazing inscriptions and carved into these walls. And I just wanted to reflect back on what we're saying here about Houston and how Houston wasn't embroiled in all of the civic strife that was so, you know, burning down the cities in the 60s and all of that. And yet there's this undercurrent of change that's been here and was part of all of that movement. Dr. King was here with Reverend Lawson and all of that. And at City Hall, it says this, "Oh, great city of vision, beautiful, strong and alert, a goddess in purpose and mean. We fight for the cause of honor, virtue, liberty, pledged to the glory of a mighty Houston." I see you chuckling there, Jerry. And all right, let me just follow this up and we'll move on. Across the hall from that, on the up along the ceiling, it says this: "As we build this city, let us think we are building forever." Mm-hmm. You know, and I found that inspirational as this naive, you know, white kid, middle class kid from the suburbs. I thought, yeah, I like this town. This is, you know, we have a lot of work to do and y'all are part of it. And we're happy to have you on Open Journal to begin and continue conversations that are difficult, conversations that are necessary, conversations that we are all part of and need to be part of. So
yeah, and maybe if I can hop in just a little bit, because I think that, you know, that inspirational element, you know, I mm-hmm. think that there's something really healthy with that. You know, I think that there's something healthy with being proud of your community. That is not what the problem is for me as an American. You know, like I want to be patriotic. I want to love the country because that means loving my neighbor and caring for my community and caring for the people who are important to me. The deeper problem, I think, becomes how is it that we measure our greatness as a city? And what I fear that we have done as a city is we've measured our greatness by the millionaires we created, but also by being blind to how the average family is doing in our city, and particularly how poor families and families of color are doing in our city. And if we can raise that standard and to measure ourselves by how we care for the most vulnerable, I think that there should be a lot that we would have potential to take pride in.
So, you know, I have a question with that. In a city and in an economy where people and capitalism requires exploitation of something or someone to find prosperity, I think a lot of our cities are feeling this in the day of COVID. Like, what is there to exploit that a poorly educated population made for a very affordable workforce, a poorly educated population made for a easily to villainize and incarcerate profit machine, that there has been some intentionality to that. How does a city, state, country that's made so much money off of deliberately exploiting, how does it still find profitability, or do we change our total business model? Can we survive without the exploitation? What do we fill that with?
Well, I tell you what, it seems as though we're on the way to finding out, because as I look at what's happening all across the United States, from the tearing down of the statues and the flags and all this other stuff, we're going to have to find a way to do better. And because right now, it really reminds me of the song by Lou Rawls, Tobacco Road. We're going to blow it up, we're going to tear it up, and we're going to start all over again. And to be able, and this is something that really vexed me. It really, and in fact, I think I really laughed at it more than anything else, because here's a person talking about that we are not going to allow our monuments and all these things to be taken down or destroyed and erase our history. Well, at the time that he's saying these things, they were tearing them statues down. So you see, if you're not going to allow, you know, the hooligans and everything else to erase the way of life and tear down the statues. But it seemed as though they're doing it anyway. So, and they're doing it without permission. Nobody's allowing them. They're doing it.
So I have a question for both of you. And this is a personal challenge that I've had trying to put clarity in the notion of monuments and history and storytelling and never forgetting and reminders of where we've been and where we've come from. There are many statues that are being taken down that are really being preserved and saved and you know, very carefully. They're not actually being destroyed. They're being, you know, saved or protected. And in some ways, it's a very subtractive to the narrative approach rather than an additive. So if you kept Dowling Street, if you kept some of these truths that were also a part of history, but just added to it, added histories of other individuals and other nationalities and other cultures that had a dynamic influence. Do you think that that would not erase pieces of the conversation, but expand it? Or does one need to go and all need to stay gone? Or, you know what I mean? Because then it reverses. If you tear down one and bring up another group's story, have we then skewed it the other way? And it's very, you know, I'm not playing devil's advocate, but just really curious about that.
I think that we really have to think about that, because what we are not talking about right now, and maybe that's for part three, is the backlash. Because you see, the black backlash have already started. And somebody is going to be upset and tear down the statue of Martin Luther King. You know, we could always find people that's upset about something. And whenever, and I love to say, whenever there's action, there is a reaction. And get ready for the backlash, because the backlash has already started. And that's something that we have to really begin to look at, and not only look at, but to talk about it. But it was very interesting. One of the Senate members that's housed right outside of DC, a couple of years ago, she offered a project that all of these monuments, rather than taking them down, write a plaque that says who the person really was and the harm that they did to the country as well as other human beings. So you have two sides of the story. But just to see the statue standing up there and all of these young kids passing by, and gee whiz, you wouldn't elect a statue unless it was for greatness, somebody was really great. But they don't see the other side of this story. So maybe there should be plaques that tell the whole story, not just a part of the story.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I think it's a really complicated thing. And what I mean by complicated is that the problems run so much deeper than the monuments. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I agree with Sherry that there has to be critical thinking in how to approach these things. And I think in many ways, I would be very comfortable with leaving those decisions in the hands of the local minority communities. And, you know, if it's a Confederate monument, what does the black population in that town want? Do they want it removed? Remove it, you know, because they shouldn't have to live under the gaze of former slave masters. Mm-hmm. But the truth is that we've been trained to forget so much of our history. And that is the biggest challenge that we have. And so when they say, you know, make a claim that we're beginning to rewrite history, we're not rewriting history when we say that Thomas Jefferson enslaved his children, that he was a sexual predator. Like, none of these things are in any way rewriting who Thomas Jefferson was. It's just reminding us of what we wanted to forget. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason that we are people who are not able to think morally, have meaningful conversations, is because we have been trained on myths that of people who never really existed in history. And the great challenge in our nation now is to, one, remember what we've been taught to forget, that where we're at it's been destruction by design all along. And when we remember the history that we've wanted to forget, we need to really think about who we want to be and how it is that we can get there. And so the idea about telling history holistically is not to denigrate the past specifically, but it is to provide a future that doesn't repeat the sins of the past. Mm-hmm. And we are writing our future as we speak. You know, we are taking part of this process. We are participants. And it is not to me about the shame game, even though it is about producing repentance. I mean, certainly the future, for us to have the future we need to get to a point where we can repent. And speaking as a white Christian male, we have never been at that point in our entire history. You know, the South had an opportunity to repent or to think that they were persecuted because of their righteousness. And of course, they saw themselves after the Civil War, not as the people who had sinned, but the people who were just suffering and trying to stay faithful as best they could. After the fall of segregation, you know, Ronald Reagan was very much against all the civil rights legislation. Even up until his presidency, he was against the civil rights legislation. And so it's not like we've ever had this time where we've been able to repent, to be able to name our sins, and to be able to start crafting an anti-racist future. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. You tuned to Open Journal, a special In Exile edition. Thank you for joining us. We're visiting with Cherry Steinwender from the Center for the Healing of Racism and Joel Goza, author and activist. Most recently, his book, America's Unholy Ghost. And we're kind of touching on that a little bit because, as you said, Joel, we're taught from a very young age an idealized version of American history, not the actual history of the United States, not the total actual history, just this really nice veneer that makes it kind of shiny and nice. And then if we even begin to discuss, as we are, exploring the totality of what this reality and this structure really is, it really becomes offensive to those who have been ensconced in power for the totality of our history. So what is it, Cherry, Joel, what is it that we can do in helping raise the level of conversation and education in a way to get us, particularly white men and women, but white people who are in the elite level, who have had the run of things for the majority of the 244 plus years since that 4th of July in 1776, knowing that we white people are going to have to feel willingly very uncomfortable to get through this. Any suggestions on how we can make that not easy, because it's not easy, it's going to be difficult, but just maybe a baby step to get us down the road
Well, what I would say is something I've been looking at and playing with for years. And if someone could come up with the formula, I would really appreciate it. The thing of it is, we have to look at to get white men to see what's in it for them to work against racism, structural, institutionalized, systemic racism. What's in it for them? Because the bottom line is, at the end of the day, every one of us, me included, what's in it for me? See, I know what's in it for me. And I'm sure Joel knows what's in it for him. But how can that formula be broadened? What's in it for white men? For white women, it's easier to understand because they have lived under the yoke of sexisms. And so they know how oppressive sexism is. And the bottom line is, a lot of the same principles and everything else that keeps sexism alive operates in racism. So white women can understand it in a way. But one of the things too, and for white women, so they know what's in it for them. But there was a time during the time of the Montgomery boycott, they would, you know, they broke ranks with their white men husbands. But you see, they didn't want to do all of that work. They didn't want to do all the washing, the ironing, the cooking, taking care of the children and everything else. So here they running across neighborhoods, bringing black women into their homes to do the work. So the thing of it is, at one time they broke ranks, and they broke ranks for one reason and one reason only, because they didn't want to do the work. And so I'm wondering now how that formula would work if white women broke ranks with white men to be able to get white men to see that it is in their best interest too to work against racism. Mm-hmm. But that's the formula. What's in it for you? And that's a good question to ask each one of you. What's in it for you?
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think, you know, I don't think anybody has, I think that that's a better question than what I have an answer for. And I'm not sure, you know, any of us have been able to figure out, you know, throughout our history, how to answer that. But, you know, when Sherry asked, you know, what's in it for us, there is a possibility we could lose some of our privileges, but regain our humanity. I mean, that is a possibility. There is a possibility we could become a city where people who work are able to feed their family and be with them on the weekends. That is a possibility. And I think part of what we have to do is, one, paint what it has cost us. You know, what has it cost us to create these radical wealth divides? You know, what has it cost us as a city to have so many millionaires, to have so many billionaires? We really need to think about the expenses that we have associated with that. And not only think about what it has cost us, but what a different future can really look like. And imagining a different future was what was so profound about Martin Luther King Jr.'s ability. And the truth of the matter is that white men have refused to have the type of imagination that MLK had. You know, so for instance, JFK could imagine a man walking on the moon, but he couldn't imagine integration in America. You know, he just didn't have the ability to imagine those things. And if we can begin imagining the world outside of the confines of white supremacy, we might find that there's a world there that's worth fighting for, that's worth struggling for, that's worth sacrificing for, and that provides a more beautiful way of life than the ways of life we've accepted for centuries in this country.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of us, Joel and Sherry, have an amazing sort of position that you've put yourself in, and that you found a way to have very challenging conversations and a very clear-minded towards a goal of better understanding sort of way. Whereas many people, they kind of hit a nerve and then the conversation totally goes off track. For those who are looking to either understand a curriculum about taking first steps, or Sherry, for those who are looking to have more in-depth conversations, are there any resources or tools, regardless of race, gender, economy, or maybe specifically for particular races, genders, and economies, that you recommend for our listeners and for ourselves?
Well, one, since we have been under locked down and we can't go into our office. All of our programs are done by Zoom. Mm-hmm. And all you have to do is go to our website. Unfortunately, I think the next two is totally booked out. So we had to close registration. However, we will be doing more. And if you just go to our website at www.centerhealingracism.org, and you'll see a lot of things that we're doing. In fact, I'm going to ask Joel if he would do a workshop with me on Zoom for our...
We'll look forward to that for sure.
Yeah.
So my website is joeledwardgoza.com. My book is America's Unholy Ghost. Another book that I think is really important right now is a best-selling book called How to Be an Anti-Racist by Abram Kendi.
Yeah.
I think he is a voice that people are listening to, and with good reason. And I think that that he really brings something into the conversation that we read right now. I definitely recommend his work. Only after reading mine, of course.
and I agree with that. I'll agree with you.
So JoelEdwardGoza.com for that access point.
And there's classes on there too. Mm-hmm. You can sign up for classes.
Yeah, you're also in the process of taking that book, America's Unholy Ghost, into an online forum as we speak. So that's something that people can look into as well. CenterHealingRacism.org for all of the great work that Cherry and all of the folks at the Center for the Healing of Racism are doing as well. This is another fascinating conversation that we're beginning to have. And I say after 2 hours that we're beginning to have this, and we will continue it in the next several weeks. We will have you back on as we continue to explore and experience this very deeply troubling and yet amazingly necessary conversation on race in America. We thank both of you for being such dear allies and friends and wonderful souls.
Thank you.
Terry Steinwender, Joel Goza, thank you so much for being on this special In Exile extended edition of the Open Journal for this great conversation.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for having. Joel, I'll send you an email.
All right, that will work.
Well, it is time to wrap this edition of Open Journal, dear friends. I'm Dwayne Bradley, and we thank you for your support of this radio station, and especially those of you who have supported this program during our fundraising campaigns over the past several months.
Mm-hmm. And I'm Stephanie Coleman. Programs are available at kpft.org. And please continue the conversation and share the conversation via our podcast, KPFT OJ. We are a dedicated volunteer production staff, including Rambling Rick Campbell, Susan Phillips, and Maverick. Open Journal theme music provided by Kevin McLeod. Join us next week on Open Journal for more great conversations. Thank you for your continued support.
And as always, we'd like to leave you with a thought for the week to carry you through. This from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., who said, "The time is always right to do what is right." Take care of each other.